So it's so interesting, we went back and just tried to see what the world even said about children, because it's not such a central theme in theology. There's so many other things connected to children, like, you know, the abortion, there's a lot written about abortion, there's a lot written about contraception, a lot about sexuality, but not so much about just parenting, or about how do we view children, what are the teachings about children. So it was really fun to kind of just go back to the tradition, and there are some really sad chapters in that history of Christianity, but there's also some very positive things. So what I'm working on now is a more thematic book, this is much more historical, on just how do we view parenting in a real spiritual way that picks up some of the themes from the Christian tradition. So that's what I'm working on. And, on this idea of the vocation of parenting and treating it as a sacred task. Because I found when we had our children, there's a lot of literature, more fundamentalist literature, that I found was too narrow in the perspective of children and focused so much just on discipline or punishment and just on and on about how you're supposed to spank these kids, when there's so much more to say about children and child-parent relationships. Or I found some kind of more New Age books that they talk about parenting as a spiritual practice, as something very important and spiritual, and I like that, actually. I like the themes, but then it didn't pick up much of the Jewish or Christian tradition, which I thought would be helpful to try to tie it to, you know, the faith traditions of Christianity or Judaism. So, anyway, the first day we talked about the purpose and paradox of parenting, and then yesterday I talked about when we look back at the tradition, I found six real helpful ways of thinking about children there, just in the second section. We talked just about what are our attitudes about kids today, but we were talking about children as gifts of God, sources of joy, as sinful creatures and moral agents, you know, recognizing they do have the developing moral capacity that that's important to talk about, developing beings in need of instruction, made in the image of God, and are fully human and worthy of dignity and respect. There's a lot of sense a lot of times that children are kind of on their way to becoming human. They're not quite fully human. And so, but that notion that they're made in the image of God, they're already fully, have this full dignity and respect that they deserve, I think is powerful too. And then we look just briefly at the gospel, which you can have on those handouts if you want later, but how it's so striking where Jesus talks about them as really kind of models of faith, supposed to be childlike. You can only come to me as a child. What does that mean? So we talked a little bit about that. And how children can sometimes be moral witnesses to our actions or vehicles of revelation. That's something not emphasized so much in the tradition, but it was in the Gospels. It's very interesting. And then, of course, there's a lot of passages about how children are orphans, neighbors, and strangers who need to be treated justly and with compassion. So anyway, we talked about that, and today what I wanted to do is, you know, if you think about parenting as a vocation that has certain duties and responsibilities, just like a profession, a doctor, lawyer, you know, as a particular vocation, or a vocation of being a husband or a wife, or a daughter or a son, what does it mean when we say, you know, what are the duties and attitudes, the spiritual duties and attitudes, and responsibilities and practices one should think about as a parent, being a parent. So I want to just talk about goals today more. What are some significant spiritual attitudes, responsibilities, and practices, real practical practices parents should carry out working with their kids to try to help them develop morally and spiritually. So I thought I have this pink handout, and I was going to go through this kind of quickly, and then just kind of really have a good discussion about what people, events, or experiences do you think were most important in your own development and formation? What kinds of things were really powerful in your own life? And then, or in the lives of people around you, what family practices do you think create family connectedness and help children develop morally and spiritually? You know, are there any particular rituals or practices that you found really helpful, either in your growing up or what you see in families today or in your own family? And then what are the central spiritual attitudes, responsibilities, and practices of parenting in your eyes? I put down a kind of, you know, just mining from the tradition some of the things they kept talking about that I thought were really very helpful. So I thought we'd just go through it kind of briefly, and then we'll have more of a discussion. So I'll give you this, and I'll kind of go through point by point. And maybe we could just, too, just say, just real briefly, you know, I'm real interested in parenting because we have a couple kids. And then I work with college students, and I see, I always wonder, you know, Aristotle said, what he was doing is not helping to shape students anymore. He was just trying to help good people understand why they do good things. They were already shaped so much by their family and what went on before that he wasn't really shaping them anymore. He was just helping them think, why do they do the things they do? So when I get the college students to me, have them in one or two classes, and we talk about helping them, you know, with their whole life, spiritually, morally, academically, there's a, you know, it just made me wonder what went on the 18 years before that, and why are some kids so, I don't know, just so great in terms of just, I don't know, out there serving others, have a kind of confidence, have a real, I don't know, compassion for others, and other kids just struggling so hard. Is there something that we could do more in the family? And then I'm just interested in issues about children, because I have that on the back of that yellow sheet. A few statistics. You don't have to look at those now, but you could look at them later. Just how so many children struggle in our society, either with poverty or lack of proper education or health care issues or depression. The teenage suicide rate is still pretty high. The teenage pregnancy rate went down, but it's still a lot of kids and being born to teenage mothers. So I just, maybe we could just say briefly your own interest in parenting and children, briefly. Then I'll go through this thing.
I'm interested in this because I have two kids. My son is 10, my daughter's 7. And as far as future interests, maybe whatever other children might come into my life. Okay. In the future, just, you know, the kids' friends or...
Right.
We also have two children, a 15-year-old son and a 18-year-old daughter, and just feel like I'm growing along with them and learning, and just, I leaned over when I told my son I started this class, and I said, do you think it's too late for me?
Yeah.
I think, you know, you can always learn, and just relating to your own kids or just, my husband's a pastor, and oftentimes, I don't know, they kind of say, oh, the pastor's right, but they have problems sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And just maybe understanding, you know, why different parents struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though I see them as good parents, some parents struggle just because of the child or just because of the way maybe they've been brought up themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, we struggle ourselves too.
Right.
At times, just different students.
Yeah, I think, you know, the nature of child and some cultural forces, they're so powerful, you know, how they affect the family and children is really played a role too in how parents struggle right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a 19-year-old daughter and lots of nieces and nephews. And I guess I see this as a real critical period in my daughter's development where she's really open to my guidance and my ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And yet old enough to, you know, really learn and start taking on some harder issues and understanding things. And I see it as with time, you know, to talk a lot with her about religion, about sex,
mm-hmm.
about our beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no, I need to start talking to her.
I'm like
a sponge right now, trying to absorb as much as I can about parenting, because I see this is a crucial time.
Yeah.
I'm sure every time is crucial.
Right. You know that these are changes just hormonally and
it's always
developmentally.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just show you a couple of these things, and then I'd like to hear too what you found really helpful in your own families, or what kind of rings true, what you say doesn't ring so true, and this is like totally absurd to talk about these as important practices and attitudes. So I'm just real open to discussing this. Well, one of the really important course responsibilities is serving, loving, and respecting children. And I think remembering children are fully human, not just sort of on their way to becoming human and worthy of dignity and respect, goes a long way in helping motivate us to give children the time and attention they need and to attend to their basic needs. Someone was starting a discussion yesterday about how just even nutrition is hard for parents sometimes. You know, just basic things. Are they getting enough sleep? Are they getting the right things to eat? But then also to treat them as individuals and to strengthen parental love and service. And there's a lot we could say about the kinds of needs they have and about what parental love is. And there's so much, there's a lot of interesting reflection of what is parental love, how is it different from friendship, how is it different from, you know, love of your spouse or love of the neighbor. So it's kind of interesting. I just pulled out a few things. We often think it certainly includes compassion, forgiveness for children. But one thing, a couple people, and I have this kind of nice bibliography too, I'll give you, but this woman, Lisa Cahill, and another man, Stephen Post, have written about parental love. They emphasize a lot that parental love doesn't close one off from the care of those outside one's own family, but opens one up to address the needs of the neighbor. I think that's kind of something we don't always emphasize, that really genuine parental love, they say, not only opens you up to the love of your own children, but kind of opens you up to a universal love and care and compassion for others. I think that happens to us sometimes. You know, we see, oh my gosh, the school system is terrible. We got to support for my kid. Then you start seeing, well, what about all these kids? And you get more involved in trying to help, you know, change the situation for some other children. It includes the love and care of children by both mother and father. It demands time and attention. And there's a wonderful philosopher, Jean Bate Elstein. She teaches at the University of Chicago. And she emphasizes a lot just how parental love is a craft. You have to be really attentive to the particular needs of each particular child and really recognize them as unique individuals with unique needs. And that I like reading her things too about this parental love as a craft. And I think one little, hi, we're having a little seminar this morning. We're just on a 1B5. That another element of parental love that a lot of theologians talk about as a real problem with parents is they try to project their own dreams on their children, their own expectations about what they are to be, kind of see them as projects. And that thinking and remembering that children are made in the image of God, that they have these unique gifts and talents, I think helps prevent, or at least stops a little bit from seeing them as they're going to become what we think they should become. They're not reflections of our own dreams. So that's a theme that came up a lot in this text. I think another one that isn't always emphasized in some of the more fundamentals literature is just enjoying children and being grateful for them. A kind of sense of gratitude, because if we believe that children are truly gifts of God, then the central way to receive them would be with gratitude and joy. So a part of that parent-child relationship should include things like laughing together, just enjoying a child's company. And psychologists talk so much about how we do need to just enjoy that child, to really, you know, kind of have that look of, oh, it's you, you know, I'm so glad it's you, and just enjoying their company. And I know some parents kind of struggle with that. They want to help their kid, but they don't necessarily enjoy them. But that's something that came up not only in the theological literature, but also in a lot of psychological literature. You're not the one enjoying your child. Just seeing the specialness about that child. Who else is going to do that as well as you can? So another thing is Calvin, he talked a lot about, he was the 16th century Reformed theologian, and he talked a lot about how it's really hard sometimes to be a parent, and that it has a lot of disappointments in this experience of parenting. And he thought that thinking of children as gifts of God, something not that belonged to you, but that belonged to God and the community, was actually very powerful in helping you get through those difficult times. He has a nice little quote, "Unless men regard their children as a gift of God, they are careless and reluctant in providing for their support. Just as, on the other hand, this knowledge that they are gifts contributes in a very eminent degree to encourage them in bringing up their offspring." So it's kind of just a larger sense, not just you're my kid, but more this, you are a child that you were sort of a gift brought in. You're going to reveal some new things to me as I help you. And that's just a kind of different attitude than, you know, you belong to me, you're going to do it this way. So I like that emphasis too.
You know, in the Luther Book of Worship, there's this prayer during baptism. I can't quote exactly, but thank you, God, for this gift that you've given them. Mm-hmm. Make them teachers, examples of righteousness for this child.
Yeah.
You know, but there's that prayer. When I, as a pastor, when I meet with parents about pre-baptism, I like to go through that prayer just to remind the parents, this is a wonderful gift that God's given you. And we're giving God thanks in this prayer because, you know, the time of baptism, everybody's kind of nervous up front.
Yeah.
But to think through that ahead of time with the parents and reflecting on this gift of God, and that we are teachers and examples of righteousness for this child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a power. It really opens them up. It opens you up more than the sense you belong to me. You know, mm-hmm. You're actually a gift brought in mind.
And let them rejoice in the gift that you can ask them from the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah.
Let them rejoice
right.
in the gift that you've given them.
Yeah.
And I just sometimes it's hard to rejoice in doing
that. Right. It is. Yeah. Luther told him that way, too, just about how the kind of drudgery sometimes of the day, dirty day person that I got. Yeah, I love it. I think, too, being grateful for children opens the door for a sense of gratitude for many simple things. You know, even just, I don't know, this. You get so into digestive issues with little babies. You know, are they, what kind of problem are they having, you know? And I don't know, there's just something about the way they just want to eat. There's something about, you know, food is really good, you know, and this kind of the process of the body, isn't it amazing? And I don't know, just maybe as soon as you get a little tuned to that, I think it helps you just be grateful for really simple things in life, a good meal. You've got some health here, you have good digestion, a good drink, you know. A good drink tastes so good. So that's part of it. Now, of course, a big theme in the tradition is, of course, instructing children in the faith. And if we understand that children are developing beings, they're moral agents, they have this developing sense of moral capacity and accountability, that they do need instruction and guidance, then we might be more intentional about nurturing their moral and spiritual lives and instructing them in the faith. And I just put down, there's the first four are emphasized in a lot of literature, about helping children, nurturing them in the home, spiritually and morally. Like there's the Search Institute in Minneapolis and the Youth and Family Institute at Oxford College, wonderful institutes that are doing a lot of research about faith formation, and they really emphasize those first four. And I think, and then I just want to say a couple more things about 5 and 6 that aren't as emphasized, I think, in some of the literature, but are really emphasized a lot in the tradition. So let me just say a couple things about the first four. I think we all know how important examples are. And, you know, Robert Coles said the most persuasive moral teaching we do as adults is by example. And I think one thing I found so helpful is example. You can be an example by what you do, but also the stories you tell. Children really appreciate stories about how you got through something, or stories about people you've admired, and just the story of their life and how they got to where they are, or stories about people you admire in the past and in the present, like, you know, in our family, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer was always kind of a model. I knew about his life from early on, or about Martin Luther King, and just hearing those stories is very powerful for children, I think. Then the second way is, of course, loving and serving the neighbor as a family. And there have been such interesting studies recently about the power on children's lives if you do a service project together, either locally or something more nationally, as a family. And this Richard Hardell, who wrote Passing on the Faith, I have that in that bibliography too, he cited a study that said, and it kind of feels bad if you do a lot of Sunday school, but it's involvement in service projects, you know, with adults, with caring adults, especially the parents, proved to be a better predictor of faith maturity, and they have a certain way of talking about what is faith maturity, but a better predictor than participation in Sunday school, Bible study, or worship. Those are certainly significant, but there was something about, they had a lot of young people talking about how meaningful it was when they went out and did the Habitat for Humanity together with their family, or they did something with other adults that they see they're caring for them. That's a very powerful formation tool. these service projects as a family. So you can do that in many ways, a local thing, food pantry, whatever, or you can do it with more national initiatives. But that was a very interesting study for me. It was kind of surprising to me.
Where did that come from? Where did
that? That's in that, it's studied by Richard Hardell and Casting on the Faith. He has a kind of number of studies where they really were working with a lot of young people. So that's important. And you can talk about, like, even with our college students, they go on these trips with the college professors. Part of it is just the trip, you know, or going out together to do this activity. And, like, I've taken them to Germany. It was more on a Luther course. And I always have so much deeper relationships with those students that even the best seminar I've had, you know, where we meet three times a week, or the students who go on these two-week projects in the spring, they with an adult, with a caring adult adventure, who can talk about what they're doing. They said that's very important in the study too, not just doing it and never talking together about it, but actually reflecting a little bit on what happened, how did you feel, what was going on as we did that thing together. So I think this other point, reading and discussing the Bible and interpretations of it, is always emphasized by everybody. Parents, that's kind of seen as a very main responsibility of parents, that they read the Bible to their children, because, of course, it's considered this central authoritative text in the tradition. And there's kind of this trust that reading the Bible to children has a positive effect on shaping their character. So it's not just seen as you do it as a little side thing, but it's really a morally shaped, a morally significant act, this act of reading. I read up, I don't think I put it on here, but there's a real interesting book. It's really kind of dense, but it's called, by Paul Griffiths, and it's about religious reading. And he talks a lot about what does it mean when you read something together as a religious text that's different from reading the newspaper or reading a novel. There's something about, you see that text is going to bring something to you, it's going to have some meaning. You not don't know. You gotta be open to the meaning it was gonna show you. And you read it more slowly, you read it out loud. A lot of times, sometimes we sing it. We sing a lot of that in the liturgy. So there's something about this act of religious reading I found real powerful, and
I don't think many people do that.
They don't.
That's just
well, it's hard.
It is.
Even as an adult, it's hard to read the Bible.
Right.
I'm reading Opening the Bible by Merton right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I just love the way he just recognizes how complex it is and how difficult it is. And if you have difficulty as an adult,
right.
even being brought up with it all your life, how
right.
hard it is to.
Right.
Right.
Right. What do you think of that? I'm supposed to that. To reading it
and
as
feel
a family.
Like you have to be a theologian
right.
and a historian
yes.
to properly interpret
right.
and the reluctance to admit to kids that you don't have a clue.
Right.
You
know?
And the too perplexed and frustrated by many of the things in there sometimes.
Yeah.
And if you could just, I've been taking my daughter to Den Erlenders Bible studies. And if I could have that, if we could have that, if we could have Dan look at that.
I think there is this pressure, though, isn't there? If I don't know, how can I be teaching?
Right.
I'm teaching it. Like, this one church started an intergenerational kind of Sunday school, and they were saying, the parents are the primary religious spiritual teachers. Mm-hmm. So we got to, I'm sorry, we're not going to be a Sunday school like you think it should be, and you drive them off.
Right.
You are going to do it in the home.
Right.
And so many people got so angry
mm-hmm.
and were scared.
Yeah.
They said, I don't know anything myself. I don't know what to say,
yeah.
even not just about the Bible, but about my own thing.
Right.
So a lot of people left the church. This is this woman, I put her name down too, but Margie Thompson. But then they started, and it grew and grew and grew, because it was so popular. And to getting beyond that obstacle of I have to be the expert that you can learn along with your kids is important. This guy, I thought he had a good idea, this Griffiths, where he said if you could just approach it with some kind of wonder, not so much, okay, we're going to sit down and teach. It sounds so bad, doesn't it? Read the Bible. It sounds so dry. All right, we're going to do it now, kids.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Sorry. You know, when I grew up, the only time we read the Bible was on Christmas Eve. We read
oh, yeah.
the Christmas story in the Bible, and that's the only time. It always felt like it was something we had to do.
Right, we had to do it.
Which is another factor is the traditions and the history of the parents haven't had that experience either.
That's right.
Parents don't have any experience to know how to do that or modeling that either.
Or their experience was awkward.
Even worse.
So it does feel awkward.
So maybe I don't know, devotional books, I guess. They're helpful because that helps them too, for them right there.
You really don't need to say a whole lot if you have a good book.
It's just a few verses. We do a devotional book that we use.
It has usually a story, you know, connected to it.
That helps, the devotional book.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were very, it was really nice, we got into the practice of reading something after dinner. And it often was one of these little devotional books, but sometimes my dad was reading a novel or something, like, or like The Little Prince we read together. And so this reading out loud as a family, it would be interwoven with some stories, and we had really funny Christmas stories, but then also the Bible, and that helped make it sort of less awkward, because we were had this sort of active reading for 10 minutes after dinner. And it was really kind of neat because we could ask questions that came up, and it was sometimes just hilarious, some of the stories my dad found. So that, I think, kind of helps break the awkwardness. Then you can interweave the biblical stuff in there. But I think he also said, if you remember, you can never mine this whole thing. It is a treasure, this Bible, that we don't know all the things about it. And have this attitude, I have questions, I don't know what it is talking about, but that's positive for children too, I think, to see, well, there's a kind of deeper meaning here that has to constantly be kind of reread and re-kind of mined each time. I think that's a healthy attitude.
Or we could have you teach something about it too, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
At certain ages, especially kids like to try and start thinking things out.
Yeah. I think that's right. Like, we had a wonderful preschool teacher who really listened really carefully to what kids were saying about certain little parables. And she would send home what they said. And, oh, it was so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So just having a sense of, well, what do you think? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Instead of, we have to have,
mm-hmm.
you know,
which is a challenge, you know, because he's a pastor. You know, a challenge for our kids, you know. For us to be more like that, because we just look at everything and say, well, what is that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly. I think, too, just helping children know passages that are meaningful to you is good, too. You can start with that. Start with, I love this text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what I got out of this one. That helps when you can jump in there instead of, let's start with Leviticus.
I like that approach instead of more wonder. You know, isn't this just wonderful?
Yeah.
How do you think about this verse?
Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, like really odd. You know?
Yeah.
Like, there are some just like really odd things, like, you know, God tried to kill Moses. You know that one part in Exodus? And our son was reading Exodus in his little Sunday school, so we were reading it. We all were going, that is so weird, you know. Wow, what does that mean? So, it was neat for him to hear. We have a real nice, the Oxford Annotated one that has all those footnotes.
Mm-hmm.
And it even said there's like, people know what this is about.
Even the notes said that in the Bible.
Yeah. So it's kind of refreshing, you know. So anyway, we found that kind of helpful. A fourth common way, of course, is carrying out family rituals. We had such a nice discussion Monday, kind of people talking about the rituals they have. And those can certainly be daily, weekly, annually. They can tie in with the church year. They could just be those nighttime rituals. Someone's talking about how meaningful the nighttime ritual is in opening up conversation. But I've just read these great books. I put them on here. Then you can have this later. But there's one. By this William Doherty, The Intentional Family, Simple Rituals to Strengthen Family Ties. And it's not necessarily tied to the tradition, but he and this Piper and another person, Gottman, I didn't put him on here, but he's a kind of a marriage counselor. Isn't it in Seattle? Gottman, yeah. And he talks a lot about the importance of rituals. Because you don't have to negotiate and say, how am I going to take all this energy? Come on, everybody, let's get going. You have to be the energizer here. It's just, well, we do this on Saturday, or we do this on Saturday. That's what we do as a family. And it creates a lot of family identity, that we're the family that does this. This is what we do. And it's, I don't know, they've had some very nice reflection about the power of ritual. And maybe we could talk about some that you found helpful.
What are the studies on when it's too late to start some of those ritual? You know, ideally you should start that probably in a very small
way. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to start there. Adolescence, I
think. Yeah. Someone did say it's really hard to start, the trust with adolescents that you want to really hear them. The caring conversation, that's kind of hard to jumpstart in adolescence. But these books are real positive in saying anytime. A tradition can. And it can be something like, we have the tradition of, well, people come up to hold, that's big tradition, you know, you gotta get everybody going, it costs money, but it could even be, you know, just we have a pizza night. We watch a movie every other week, or something like that, when you're doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can start anytime. It's something, they have a real nice way of talking about this, in that, I think it's a Doherty book about, anytime you start doing something fun and you recognize it's pretty fun, that you can make it into a tradition by just, and a ritual, by saying, well, we're going to do this again, and this is the time, this was meaningful to our family, let's kind of do this again.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's ever too late to start. And they mentioned a lot about how you have to keep revising your rituals. You can't, something that was important as a six-year-old, it's like, I don't want to do that again.
I don't want to sing that song at that time.
Right. The song they wanted their whole life.
Yeah.
But they kind of keep saying, keep checking in and seeing what's important, what's meaningful. Everybody, I thought that was helpful. I just want to talk a couple minutes about these next two, because the music thing is so interesting. Training children in music and exposing them to the best kinds of music. That's not emphasized so much, but I've seen in our college students, for example, how powerful music is to them. And they have these tapes running in their head. They have a lot of, you know, they're listening to a lot of music. They have something going on in their head. And the one guy, Griffiths, talks about how we all have a sort of memorial library, that these things kind of keep coming up and up and up. Well, you want to make sure you get some things in that memorial library of your kid that are good tapes, that you would say are good messages. And Luther and Bart were so good about talking about music can be very good just in terms of helping us feel good and healing our emotions. It's very powerful that way. It's music that affirms life, that isn't sort of angry or bitter, but affirms life, can see the complexity of life, but affirm life. But then Luther goes on and says, oh, music is really important too, because it can be a vehicle for transporting the word of God to the human heart. And I see that so much in these powerful music programs at Lutheran colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, and so many young people who become lay leaders or just really active in service projects, music has been really powerful for them. These music groups, probably just sociologically, psychologically, you look at it, a lot happens in a choir or a band or something. Community, camaraderie, a nice mentor. You're doing something together that creates something more than you could do individually, so they see the power of a group. So even that, you know, you could just stop there. But then if you add some of the sacred music, or the message is kind of coming through some of the sacred music, it's very life-shaping. And I just have been, I don't know, it's been confirmed to me again and again how powerful music is. And if you don't get if you don't get your tapes in there, somebody else is getting those tapes in there. And a lot of, that's not to say, you know, young people shouldn't, we should say you must only listen to certain kinds. But gosh, if their daily dose is really, really very angry music or very cynical music, I think that has an effect on them. So you want
to... Boy, peer pressure is the other thing, too. You know, what are my friends listening to?
Yeah.
How important is it to know what they're listening to so we can have a common language or something? If they talk about this band or this song, and I have no clue what that is,
mm-hmm.
I need to listen. And even though the song may not be that great, it's what the peers are listening to, and so we need to find something That's sometimes a challenge too.
Yeah.
The desire to listen to the music is hard for me.
The desire?
For me to sit down and actually just stick with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. To listen to what they're...
Some of the more angry and the... Mm-hmm.
And my son comes up here and puts on, you know, he goes on the hikes, you know?
Okay, she's looking at the stage, really, yeah.
Yeah.
But I was so glad that he replaced it, the second hike we went on, with a book. So he was walking up there, you know, reading the book.
What do you do about music? What do you, maybe, you know, how do you? Because, you know, there is that kind of sense, oh, it's just entertainment, it's not so powerful. And there is that attitude of, oh, it's kind of going in and out. But then there's others who say, you know, it really kind of does shape something. And it is a kind of theme then running through their head, these lyrics, because they are so powerful. I mean, that's why we have liturgy, because it's more powerful to sing the biblical stuff. It gets in you easier than just saying it. There's a wonderful book by this Neusner just talking about why is music so important in religious traditions? Because it's a lot of it's just sung. The word is sung because it sinks in deeper. But maybe you have to be kind of attuned, but what do you do about the music?
Just ask them to think about, is it life-affirming? What are you listening to? And, sometimes I quote my mom, grandma, so you know, grandma says garbage in, garbage out.
Don't let your kids see the
garbage.
Don't
let
your kids see the garbage. And that's what we say about some videos or movies.
Videos.
We as parents will not let you eat from the garbage can. So that's why I would say no to this movie.
Yeah.
Or this music or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And there are some good sources on the internet too, reviews of movies, videos,
and songs.
And songs too.
You can check out the content.
There's different
Screenit.com is a good one.
Screenit.com, that's for
movies and videos. It is very explicit as far as it tells you everything in the movie.
What you should know as a parent.
It ruins the movie for you.
Well,
it's very detailed.
In fact, when you see that website, sometimes you'll read that and you go, there's no way my kid should watch that movie, but when you actually watch the movie, you go, it really wasn't as bad as you read every swear word and every, and you go, wow. Mm-hmm. So, it could be a little misleading. There's nothing about celebrity. I think that's adoption or that includes music on that one.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes you can have them even read, you know, this is what it says about this movie, you know, have them look at it too. This is what it says. Do you think
this is something you want to read? But all my friends are gone.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it gets hard. I don't have teenagers yet, but I've heard some people say they sit down and watch that and they bring them. Mm-hmm. But they don't enjoy it quite so much. They don't enjoy it as their parents. They kind of have that perspective of what really is going on. Mm-hmm. So, And I've heard teenage parents talk about, parents of teenagers, about what a really good is that the contemporary Christian music scene is pretty hot. Because that really helps. Because, I mean, it used to be a lot of times the rock and roll was the kids wanted to rock and roll, Christian music scenes. But now the rock and roll Christian scene is really, and not only there, but kind of cutting edge in a lot of ways. So it's really helped a lot of parents.
Yeah. I was doing it. Got so excited about that. I wrote a paper on this. It was neat because he didn't like writing papers, but he loved music, and he got into this. Just what are the kind of different kind of Christian groups, and how are they labeled, and why are they doing it? That was really interesting. I saw his passion just open up with that.
The other thing for our kids is the choirs at school. We have, we're fortunate to have choir directors who like to use religious music in the choir in schools. Mm-hmm. And I know our teenage boy was saying, you know, we're singing these religious songs, and they keep going through my head all day long. Mm-hmm. So that's good. And we thank the choir director after a concert. We said, thank you for using these kinds of songs, because our voice is, he keeps going through his head, and that's what we want going through his head.
it's neat. Our church is really good, too, just about the liturgy. They have kind of one setting for like 4 months, then the next setting for 4 months, the next setting. So they use a Marty Howard, but they use LPWA things, but they do it like in 4 month chunks. And the reason they do that is so it gets in the minds of the kids. And it is neat. And like we were biking and our son was just, you know how you when you're biking, sometimes you're humming along or singing, and he was singing, you know, some parts of the liturgy. It was neat. And I think just even that repetition, if you go to church regularly, then at least that's kind of in their head.
We don't do quite as long. We do that same kind of thing. We do two services with the same liturgy, but usually it's about 6 weeks. And then we change.
Oh, yeah. Well, 6 weeks is a good chunk of time, too.
Yeah.
To get it in there.
Yeah. My kids sing, you know, church songs, but I'm a singer, too, so they get it in their head.
I think singing as a family is really fun, too. We sing a little something at the table or sing a song together. Our son takes piano, so we'll say, oh, let's sing a song. And he kind of sometimes says, oh, I love that song in the amateur, just sing that song. So that's kind of a nice way you can have a devotion that's giving kind of a nice message in there without making it sound too sterile. Well, let me just say a couple of little things here about providing close contact, number six on the 3B6. I found this so important, too. It's not emphasized so much today when we talk about formation of young people, but providing children with close contact to the natural world and cultivating reverence for creation. I think everybody here kind of knows that. You feel yourself how renewing it is. Mm-hmm. But I think more and more young people don't have, unless you're real intentional, you know, you can certainly do it in your garden or even as a little potted plant or something, no matter where you live. But they're more and more, if you're spending so much time watching television, playing computer games, playing video games, more and more disconnected. And, you know, there are so many examples in the tradition and today, I think, of how close contact with the natural world and attention to it have been real deep sources for spiritual growth. And I think we could all name so many benefits of like coming to a place like this. But even doing simple things in your own backyard. How renewing it is, how healing it is, how it kind of gets you back to what are the basic needs. I think it's really hard for young people even to know what are basic needs anymore, apart from wants or desires. Because if you haven't really, I don't know, camped or, you know, just been in a more primitive setting, it's hard to know. I think they could believe you cannot live without certain games they have or certain gadgets.
Especially for girls. I mean, I just love to see the self-esteem that comes from backpacking and knowing you can take care of yourself. Your basic needs.
So I think that's an important one.
We have a trip. The kids go to the Boundary Waters in Northern
Minnesota. Oh, isn't that great?
And that's really good. And they intentionally give them time for journaling. They go out by themselves in the wilderness, you know, in the Northwoods, and just reflect on creation. That's been very helpful for some of the kids in the way they find that.
We're looking at the young people who are these counselors at these Bible camps, and how powerful they are in the church. The ELCA Jonathan Strander is trying to do a study now of how so many pastors, but also lay leaders, have come out of those Bible camp settings. That was so shaping. And you wonder, it's like, it's certainly, gosh, the rituals are there, the wonderful camp counselors. You got, I don't know, just the other peers saying something about religion, I mean, is powerful in itself. But the setting, too, I was saying, would it work in a Marriott? Would the same thing have worked in a Marriott, you know, in a Plimpton? There's something about stepping out I don't know, being in a simpler setting. Well, I'll just mention, where are we doing on time? Oh, we got it. I'm just going to show you these and I won't even keep elaborating, okay? So then we can talk more. But I was kind of impressed. The real emphasis on education is really important. That's a big responsibility. And certainly we all see the commercials about you gotta get your college fund ready. But many theologians, they got really into schools and education, not only because they said you know, especially Protestants, if you want to read the Bible, you got to learn to read. So that's partly why schools got started. Just, you know, if we think that's important, well, they better learn to read. So, but they also said, and you'll see this in Luther, Branca, all these performers, Calvin, that you've got to have good skills to be able to serve other people. So if you're going to be a good doctor, you've got to have a good education and know what you're doing there. You've got to, if you want to be a good politician or, you know, a CPA, you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to hone those skills. You have to have an excellent education. So it's a real priority that it's not just because of the religious, well, it's tied to serving others. It's also so you can read the Bible, but service to others. And I think helping children find their sense of vocation more particular is an important job of parents. And that happens in a lot of ways, you know, through prayer. But I found with my college students, what's so interesting to me, just naming their gifts, just saying, wow, you know, you're really good at that, is so powerful for them. And they said, you know, I thought about becoming this or that, but no one said anything. I had this one student, he would have been a great engineer, but he's a great pastor too. And he just wrote these great papers. He was such a wonderful man. He was a real leader. And I said, just a tiny little note, it was like scribbled like that, you know, just, you know, have you ever thought of ministry? You have real gifts in ministry. And he came into my office and he said, you know, I've always thought about, but no one ever said to me, you know, you might make a good pastor, but I've always been nagged by that. But I went this kind of route of the safe engineering thing because I didn't get any support from anybody. And then it so happened, our campus pastor told him that same week he had gifts for ministry. So he went to seminary. He's going to be a great pastor. Isn't that interesting though? But it was so powerful. And just a passing remark. It wasn't even, oh, let's work together for months and months. I'm going to be your mentor. It was nothing like that. It was just a naming. Mm-hmm. And I think parents have that job too, to just kind of see, what are your gifts? How could you serve other people? So I think learning from children, I'm so big on this. And we went through those gospel passages yesterday that are so powerful about children being models of faith. Children kind of as moral witnesses. They see what we're doing and they witness how we are living, and we need to really straighten up our act, I think, because children are moral witnesses. And the fact they can be vehicles of revelation, they reveal something to us about God. That doesn't mean they're necessarily more spiritually deep or something, but they can reveal something to us about how we are to live or what we are to do. So I have a real, I'd like to hear from you.
How do parents be careful if they don't impose their own kinds of expectations? I mean, parents can have their own lenses or their ideas of what they want their kids to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's danger of parents pushing their kids into a particular occupation or job because that's what they want to do.
Yeah. I think that is such a tendency. We talked about that just at the very beginning, just before we came here, because we were saying, you know, we were talking yesterday about how if you really see children as made in the image of God with their unique gifts and talents as unique individuals, if you see them also as gifts of God, not necessarily belonging to you, but belonging to God and belonging to the community, that can help prevent that a little bit. I think we all, you know, have certain dreams we wanted to live out, and it's easy to see them lived out in the children. But there was a wonderful little quote that said, don't see your child as a project, but a revelation. And I think you certainly need to guide your children, but sort of just seeing, well, what are you kind of good at? You are really good at that, and you could help a lot of people that way. And I think some of that can be helped by doing these service projects too, because a lot of young people learn their gifts by doing certain activities with others. And then you're with a bunch of other adults who might name their gifts too in the community.
Yes,
and having more adults around them than just you, I think that also prevents that from happening. Because they might say, you know, I saw you were really good at that, where the parent can only see the medical doctor, you know, imprinted. But that just having another adult mention it to you is helpful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know, but learning from children, I think, is really important. And then helping all children are missed and working for justice. That's, you know, we don't always think that as a parental responsibility because it's you know, I'm supposed to watch out for my children. But I love that theme in the tradition. It's you are, as a, though all of us are called to really watch out for the children in our midst, and parents too. So I think children seeing that is also very positive, that you care about other children in your midst. Well, so those are some of the things. I put some questions up there that we can keep talking about, but like what people, experiences, or events were most important in your own development that you think are powerful, or what family practices help create family connectedness and help children develop more spiritually, and what are the central spiritual energies? What would you have added to this list?
Well, I can jump in anymore, but went right off number three, you know, spiritual attitudes, responsibilities, I think the use of money.
Yeah.
I would add to that list. Mm-hmm. How we use our money.
Yeah.
Would be an important teaching thing for mm-hmm. children to
yes.
learn that, and consumerism and what we buy. And
mm-hmm.
Why we don't have two boats like neighbors.
Yeah.
Why we've chosen.
Think of how we use our money, give our money to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And not putting the neighbors down, but just why this is a different choice that we made, and try to, you know, not be judgmental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our college students too are in serious debt.
Yeah.
Not from their college loans, but from their
credit cards. And the credit card companies get them. I mean,
they're unrelenting.
They're just sending them stuff. And
yeah. And they keep saying, you know, be responsible. Get your credit card, start your credit record, or you might have a hard time getting a job. It's
right.
just like, oh, okay, well,
I'm
going to do that,
yeah.
you know. But there's serious problems with that. So then they start out their career, you know, with a terrible debt. And then parents struggle with that. So,
yeah.
But I mean, if you go to the stream, though, where you're just, you know, so cautious about spending money and stuff, but that almost becomes like attitude. I mean,
mm-hmm. yeah,
really
right.
We see that in our parents sometimes, you know.
That balance
yeah.
is hard.
Yeah.
But I think that's really good. They say, we had a wonderful workshop, this one conference about, you know, just talking to children about money. People are talking to them about money and how you're using your money.
Mm-hmm.
And you really got to start young. We have a really neat bank for our son. It has green, yellow, red. And green is go, you can use the money.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow is wait, you want to buy something special.
Mm-hmm.
Save your money.
Mm-hmm.
Be cautious. And red is you never invest that. You know, I mean, sorry, you never spend it. You just invest it. You save that. And we made the green one for the poor. You give 10% for whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, for the poor. And then the yellow is just, hey, it's your spending money, but be careful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only be careful. And then red is, you know, you have to invest that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we started, you know, it was three, four, I think. Just, well, we always give some money to
mm-hmm.
the others. And we talk about, you know, what are we writing this check for?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that was
helpful. Well, we didn't do the college, we had three jars that we kind of identified.
Oh, yeah.
And is that money that they earned from allowance, or was that just to give money to them to wise money use?
Well, for us, it was allowance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We struggle with that. We never got allowance, so it's like, and I don't know, I still struggle with that. It was gift money, actually,
mm-hmm.
all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah,
but
that's right. That's what I'm thinking, too. Not like they earned it.
They never got paid for doing jobs. It was just kind of like, it was just a money management thing.
Right.
$1.50 a week.
Right. And how are you going to spend it?
Right.
And they say that that's important.
Mm-hmm.
A little, some way that they budget.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you blow it, you blew it.
Right.
You know, let them blow it.
Yeah.
A couple times.
Having a brother or sister, one who spends and one who spends.
Yeah.
It's interesting to
look at that animal. Right. You're talking to say, do you really need another little stuff? It's Sunday school. I have the hardest time sending my daughter to Sunday school because she absolutely hates it. And I'm sending her in a room with somebody who I'm not sure of their spiritual mindset or of their ability as a teacher and their volunteers and, you know, bless them. But, so we never, she sits in church with us. She doesn't go to Sunday school. And
oh, is she?
She's 10 now. And, and often it's really dry. It's, and even compared to school, it's even drier than school. It's we cut 15 minutes and we have snack for 10 minutes and we talk. And it just doesn't appeal to her at all. And she'd much rather sit in worship. And I just wonder how you guys handle it, or if your kids go to Sunday school, or it's mandatory, you must go, or, you know, what do you do?
Change your son.
I know.
We have a workshop model, we have three workshops that the different age groups rotate through each week, and they start with ones. Each workshop has a different way of looking at a biblical story. So, we took a survey about how whether the kids like Sunday school, you know, about four years ago, and you know, it was unanimous that they didn't like it.
It's a Lutheran thing, I think.
So we changed to this model, and you know, and I think now they probably, you know, appreciate Sunday school. You know, they're not bouncing off the walls, you know, loving it, that kind of thing. Yeah. But it's certainly much more interesting and involved more of the people in the congregation. And we're constantly fine-tuning. And you can get all the information you need to start one on the internet. It's on www.rotation.org.
Rotation?
Rotation.org.
I always remember Dan Erlinger telling the story of how they shared with a Jewish school, Sunday school, and the Lutherans were upstairs and the Jewish kids were downstairs, and how they were sitting up there, you know, having their little lesson, and the kids downstairs, they were like building the ark, and they were just, you know, just having a headache, you know, they were acting it out to the Bible. Right. And you know, even Narnia reflects a little bit of Lutheran Sunday school sometimes, I think.
But you know, the other aspect that you mentioned too, you know, that it's you have to find teachers that are able to have a sense of God in that space, and sense of the holy and sense of their own faith life. And I think probably we're looking at 10% of our congregation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a survey as far as maturity of Christians and Lutherans were 24%, right on the bottom of the list.
Yeah, and I think the church gets so desperate for teachers that they just keep pleading from the pulpit, and then people just say, oh, I'm not really gifted at this, you know, which would be me. I'm not gifted at teaching Sunday school, which makes me even, you know, less able to try to do something about it. I'm better one-on-one with kids than I am with kids in big group.
What do you think she would be drawn to?
You know, just anything more like camp, when she goes to Christian camp, you know, where they do things and they don't just sit and maybe they talk more about personal things instead of being kind of preachy. I don't know.
Well, this is a kind of countrywide problem.
Yeah.
I mean, you must see that there's the Lilly Endowment just did a survey of Sunday school curriculum and satisfaction with Sunday school, and it really is really a problem with the teachers. It's a serious problem.
Well, I think we should pay our teachers. I mean, I think it would be better for them to be, if the church could afford it.
We have paid a couple of
teachers.
Even though I'm full time there.
Was that what you say?
We have paid a couple of people. Mm-hmm. We paid a drama person who's done some drama with our kids because, you know, I could do it, but I couldn't do it as good a job as he could.
Or maybe not do it all at once. Maybe have a couple marvelous people that maybe have Sunday school at different times. Yeah. You know, for every age or something.
You know, some people found this intergenerational Sunday school. It's really nice. It's like everybody comes. It's from, you know, age 3 to 90. Mm-hmm. And you come and someone does, they do, like, they put down a piece of paper and kids in a color why they're talking about the story, they read the story, they do some song, people talk about it. But it's kind of neat because we don't have that many occasions where children are overhearing what adults are saying, but children can participate. And that Marjorie Thompson, she's the one who's real big on this intergenerational Sunday school, where the parents, the children see the parents have a kind of stake in it. Uh-huh. And maybe something one person could do is just say, could we start a small group, just a kind of experimental small group Sunday school where we worked with this group, see if we like it, where you went with your kids to the Sunday school. You know what I mean?
What is Margaret Thompson group?
She wrote this book, I put it on here, the Faith Family the Forming Center, I think. Family the Forming Center. A vision of the world of family and spiritual formation. Because she, like her dad, like all these people, are saying so much about it really has to be, if things aren't resonating in the home, it wouldn't even matter if you had the best Sunday school ever. If something isn't, it's like, and then you think of the overwhelming other influences on children. Like, you have the 1 hour of great Sunday school. Then you have 27 hours of television. It's like, how can it compete if there's not some little rituals going on? So I mean, even the fact that you're sitting with your children in the worship, that's very positive. Because that's
what you see that when a parent dropping to Sunday school.
To the great Sunday school.
And they never sit with their parents.
I think to choose between two is better to stay with the family and church.
That's why I don't like Sunday school direct to church. We don't do it that way.
So many do it. Mm-hmm. And that's so sad, I think, too.
It's American efficiency.
Right. You pay that 1 hour in.
Well, it's also a space crunch, you know.
Oh, true.
You get so many people, and you don't have the room for people in the sanctuary anymore.
Oh, that's true.
That you have, either you build a bigger church, or you have to do something with the time.
Mm-hmm. So. I think you might want to feel a talk about that Sunday school. You know, anybody, because partly you want, if let's just say, hey, why not just go to worship with your child? That's good. It is good. It's better than in the best sense, but there's something nice when some other adults are saying the same things you're saying, but they're saying it a little different way and a little different method, and that you get this resonance then between the home and the extended family and the church, and that it's not just you saying things. So that's where.
Have you talked to either the pastor or Christian director or anybody about your concerns?
Our pastor has changed, like, we have had a lot of turnover. I think we've had a lot.
Yeah. Where are you from?
The St. Simon's Hills. We've had a lot of turnover.
Oh, okay. You're from Seattle, so.
But I think, you know, maybe just say, let's try to experiment. That's not so threatening then. To say, are there a couple other families? You know how these most churches have those small groups? We just have, let's have a small group that meets in Sunday school, but call it Family Sunday School. See if it works. What are some other things you know, that you found really helpful or where your concerns are? I love what you said about money and Sunday school.
Well, sexuality is another, area too. You know, how do we understand sexuality? You know, even the adolescent years. Appropriate to show signs of affection, how to show affection, be a sexual person, but again, have some boundaries. Yeah, talking about that.
It's really funny when my college students, they had never, most of them, I would say 95% of them, have not had a good conversation about sexuality within their church. 95% of the ones who went to church. We have a lot of committed Christians in our particular university. But that's something. It's like, it's hard to talk about it. I mean, it's but we need to talk about it. So some people have found it's real helpful, again, to have a kind of a group talk about it together. And that's something at church, a kind of a forum or something, and then you go home and talk about it. So it's not just you, again, coming up with it, but if you have some kind of concerns and questions there, and then you can get home, that can be helpful. Just even having one forum, a couple forums.
Right, the opportunity for further discussion.
Yeah, that can help.
Do your resources have any
on the sexual topic? I don't know. I guess too, we'll run out of time, but.
Actually, I think I found a good book for teenagers, because we struggle with really fundamentalist.
We're looking at bookstores for books on sexuality.
Yeah, healthy sexuality.
Most of the fundamentalists have some books out there. They're not very many others.
And that's what I was saying yesterday. I find the fundamentalists at least they've taken parenting seriously. Mm-hmm. They're saying, mm-hmm. and they take family problems seriously, and mm-hmm. we've got to talk about this stuff, and I love that about mm-hmm. what they're doing, but then some of it is so narrow, or so harsh, or so, just not, doesn't have those dimensions of children we're talking about. It's just mm-hmm. also, you know, almost like they're just defiant and sinful, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. And so your job is discipline, instruction, mm-hmm. punishment.
Yeah.
Real emphasis on punishment, you know,
yeah.
as the main thing you're supposed to do when there's such a rich child-parent relationship, I think. So I just encourage more people to be writing a lot in the mainline traditions,
mm-hmm. yeah.
not focusing,
right. you
know, make parenting a topic,
right.
and children a topic.
Well, I haven't read the book, but have you read Barbara Dawn, Children is a Lost Cause?
Yeah,
is
I have that on there.
Is that helpful book?
It's kind of helpful in the sense of just, hey, what is going on with our children? And so she mentioned some of the struggles with consumerism and television,
mm-hmm.
and just how I think it helps you start thinking about some things.
But that's more for the parents, you know, mm-hmm. than for a kid to read.
Yeah,
as far as it,
right, the concerns, right. Dorothy Bass will come out with a book. This you should watch for. It will be with Josie Bass. Did I push one? I don't think I did. But she has a book called Practicing Our Faith. It's Dorothy Bass, B-A-S-S.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of good because it's going to be published by Josie Bass. They're not related, but J-O-S-S-E-Y Bass.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to come out with a book. She did it with a bunch of people on practicing our faith for teenagers.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Is that the name of it, or no?
I don't know. It will be in the Practicing Our Faith series. It should come out in a year, maybe.
Wow.
And that will be helpful. They wrote the authors. It's all contributed. This Practicing Our Faith book is like, how do we practice the Sabbath? How do we honor the body? What about sexuality? What about saying yes and no? What about money? Kind of how do we live it out?
For teenagers.
For adults.
For adults.
And so then they thought, well, let's get together some contributors with young people they love, either their own children or like one woman was single. She had no children. And she did it with her niece. And then they wrote together, like, what does it mean to read the Bible? What does it mean to honor the body as a teenager?
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be a neat book. I've mm-hmm. read a few chapters of it.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So look for that. That might help.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Well, gosh, thank you for your discussion. It's really neat to have your input.
Mm-hmm.
Are you teaching?